Welcome to the Anxiety Lab. It's good to have you, all of my Anxiety Labradoodles. I couldn't be more excited for this episode today with Dr. Judd Brewer. If there was a guest made for this podcast, it's Dr. Judd. Maybe we did make him. Maybe we grew him in the lab. Dr. Judd is a neuroscientist, researcher, New York Times bestselling author, as well as a thought leader in the field of habit change. Specifically, and this is why I was so stoked to have him on, he's used mindfulness to achieve some rather astonishing results around anxiety reduction, not to mention smoking, as well as emotional eating. What I love about him is not only does he have a very clear, concise way of presenting what are practical tools for anxiety relief, but also his entire approach is rooted in ancient meditative practices around the principles that we talk about so often on this podcast, such as non-judgmental awareness. You know, we're not pushing away anxiety or bad habits, nor are we demonizing ourselves for having them. Rather, we're opening up. We're getting curious. We're paying attention. And in that process, real wisdom can emerge and lasting change can happen. Dr. Judd breaks it down in a way that's, you know, refreshingly specific and actionable. And if you're into it, I would definitely check out his book, Unwinding Anxiety: New Science Shows How to Break the Cycles of Worry and Fear to Heal Your Mind. I would say that's required reading for anyone who's anxious. Dr. Judd is also the Director of Research and Innovation at Brown University's Mindfulness Center, as well as Executive Medical Director at ShareCare, which is a leading digital health company. Other than that, thanks for listening. If you're new and you like it, I would point you to any of the previous episodes. We try to keep things generally timeless around the topics, and I've worked hard on the episode, so would love to have you support. Speaking of which, if you don't mind taking a second and writing me a review on Apple Podcasts, or if wherever you're listening has a place to review, even if you're listening on an app like Overcast, if you could just quickly open up Apple and throw me a rating and review, that would be awesome, if you're into it. Don't force it if you're not feeling that. I think I'm going to keep this one brief. I think the last thing I'll say is, yeah, I mentioned this last time. I developed an app that's a kind of a mindful social media app. It's a very simple app that provides two benefits. The first is gratitude. It is a place where you can reflect on a couple things you're grateful for in your life. A gratitude practice has pretty undeniable mental health benefits, according to numerous scientific studies. And the second component of this app is, through the gratitude practice, you get paired with a different user each week. And this part is just meant to be a kind of a slower, more mindful alternative to the overwhelm of most social media. So that's it's 100% free. We're in a private beta phase. Anyone who wants an invitation, just go to landadapt.net, and we're pretty generous with handing those out. All right. I am Sagar Bhatt. You can contact me at S-A-G-A-R-B-O-T on Instagram, or theanxietylab@gmail.com if you want to get a little bit more formal and write in with a question or maybe something you want to hear discussed on a future episode. Dr. Judd, you can find at drjudd.com or dr.judd on Instagram, or Judd Brewer on Twitter. I'll put that in the episode description. That's all I got. Enjoy this episode with Dr. Judd Brewer. All right, Dr. Judd, welcome to the Anxiety Lab.
Thanks for having me.
I feel like I am domain squatting. I feel like Anxiety Lab should be something that you should have the rights to as a name for whatever you do.
Well, you know, I think we all deal with anxiety. I think this should be a universal domain.
Yeah, I am finding out, especially through doing this podcast now, that it is more universal than I thought. And that in itself provides relief. The other thing that provides relief is, or that has provided relief recently, is your incredible book, Unwinding Anxiety. First off, just congrats for writing that. I think it's amazing.
Oh, thank you.
So I'd love to start by introducing to the listeners this concept of habit loops. I've mapped out some of my own habit loops, but before we get into that, do you mind just giving the listeners some background in terms of kind of just in general looking at anxiety as a habit, as well as this specific exercise of mapping out habit loops?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And this actually came from my own anxiety. So I've certainly had anxiety, panic attacks, and things like that personally. But this came from my anxiety of helping my patients with anxiety. And the reason for that was that in medical school, I learned, you know, to prescribe medications for patients. And the best medications out there, there's this term number needed to treat that gives us a sense for how well a medication works. For the medications for anxiety, that number needed to treat is 5.2, meaning that I play the medication lottery. For every 5 patients that I prescribe medication to, one of them shows a significant reduction in symptoms. So I don't know which is going to be that lucky person, who that's going to be. And I also don't know what to do with the other 80% that don't respond well to medication or might have side effects or whatnot. So, you know, it really came out of a need where, you know, it was like, wow, boy, this is not working. How can I help my patients? And serendipitously, my lab had been studying habits, you know, how to help people break bad habits. So I'm trained as an addiction psychiatrist. I'd done some early work with alcohol and cocaine use disorder in terms of studying mindfulness to see how well it worked. It worked pretty well. I did a study with training people in mindfulness for smoking cessation. And we got 5 times the quit rates of gold standard treatment. So we're thinking, wow, okay, there's something here. And then we'd started developing app-based mindfulness training programs. And we're studying one called Eat Right Now. And we got 40% reduction in craving-related eating. So we're thinking, okay, that's, you know, pretty good. And we were starting to work out the mechanisms, both the behavioral and the neural mechanisms. And in the Eat Right Now program, somebody said, hey, you know, I'm noticing that anxiety is triggering my eating. You know, can you create a program for anxiety? And so I was thinking, well, I prescribe medications, but it put a bug in my ear to go back and look at the mechanism. And so here's a long answer to your short question, which is, you know, we all learn to form habits through a very basic learning process called reinforcement learning. It was set up to help us remember where food is and to avoid danger. Has three elements: a trigger, a behavior, and a result. So you can think of our ancient ancestors out on the savannah. You know, they've got to find food. They don't have refrigerators. So when they find food, they see the food, there's the trigger. They eat the food, there's the behavior. And then their stomach sends this dopamine signal to their brain that says, remember what you ate and where you found it. Same is true for avoiding danger. They see the danger, they run away, and their reward is that they survive. Well, it turns out, which I didn't learn in medical school, that anxiety is driven the same way. So anxiety itself, the feeling of anxiety, can trigger the mental behavior of worrying. That mental behavior makes us feel like we're in control, or at least we're doing something. And that is rewarding enough to feed back and drive anxiety habit loops. So I started approaching this from a behavioral mechanistic perspective and say, hey, can we create a program that helps people with anxiety by targeting these habit loops rather than just telling people, you know, the cognitive therapy is, you know, catch it, check it, change it, you know, change these cognitions, use willpower, things like that. A lot of research showing that willpower doesn't really work that well, if at all. And that's why a lot of people struggle here. So we developed this unwinding anxiety app, started testing it. Long story short, did a couple of studies. Our first study with anxious physicians, we got a 57% reduction in clinically validated anxiety symptoms. Did a study with people with generalized anxiety disorder. In this randomized controlled trial, we got a 67% reduction. And here we could calculate that number needed to treat. So with medications, 5.2. In this study, 1.6. So
that's incredible. So
if an app could do a mic drop, you know, boom. So that's what prompted this whole idea around, you know, approaching anxiety through basically how our brains work, leveraging these really strong learning mechanisms to actually help people overcome anxiety.
Yeah. And one of the exercises is mapping out these habit loops. And I think you know, before I get into mine, I just want to, I mean, I love that you're on this podcast because one of my mission statements with anxiety is whatever you're dealing with in your mind, throw it into the lab, meaning observation is always available.
Yes.
And even just the act of, I'm going to look at this and just be aware of it, maybe builds a little bit of space. So that on its own is a profound shift, right?
Absolutely.
And so we go through these habit loops. I mean, there's, you know, maybe to me, these are maybe the more simple ones, such as I'm experiencing something uncomfortable. And so I crave a chocolate cake or something. And then I eat the cake and then I feel good for a while. And I guess it's also sometimes true that I might not even know that I have an emotional disturbance. It's just showing up as a craving for something sweet. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm. So our brains, when there's something unpleasant, for example, like anxiety, our brains try to make it go away as quickly as possible. And the better we get at reacting quickly, the more rewarded we are because there's less of that unpleasantness that's sticking around. It goes away more quickly. So often this can happen, you know, start to happen so quickly that we're not even aware of it. For example, you know, my patients who struggle with smoking, sometimes they'll come to me and they'll say, you know, I just woke up and I had this half-smoked cigarette in my hand and I had no idea where it came from because it's so automatic where, you know, something unpleasant triggers them to crave a cigarette, they light up and they're not aware of any part of that process because it's so automated.
Right. And when you're dealing with something highly addictive, then it could just take a life of its own once you're introducing this external chemical that's not a natural part of our physiology.
Absolutely. And, you know, I would extend that not just to chemicals, but to technology, because technology is now highly addictive. People have figured out that mechanism as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. I mean, that leads us to my next habit loop that I mapped out. This one is, you know, if I write, I also have a part-time day job where I'm doing some calculations. And, you know, when either thing gets hard, I will, or even if I'm writing an email where I need some thought for that email, if I'm trying to pitch something of that nature. And as soon as something gets difficult, I have trouble phrasing something or I get overwhelmed with how to write the next few sentences, I go to maybe just check the email. Maybe I'll check a financial portfolio. Maybe I'll check Instagram if I just posted something. Maybe I'll check podcast stats. And all of these, I call this, I'm just like kind of checking stats or checking the score. It's the same energetic quality to all of these distractions.
Yes.
The form of it changes. Even when I tell myself I'm off Instagram for like a month, which I will do, YouTube will just fill that void. And now I'll go to YouTube. And so it's, you know, similar to a piece of cake, it's that temporary satisfaction. And I guess in the long run, it actually leaves me in more of a deficit. And I guess, you know, I want to not to get very heavy, very fast, but I know you're also trained heavily in mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And for me, when I look at what it is that's driving the need to check Instagram, I think it is some craving for a solid self. You know, I am kind of looking for some certainty about who I am. If I get 100 likes on a recent post, that, you know, the craving for that, in that experience of craving, I am maybe thinking of myself as that kind of person, or I've shored up all of these feelings of uncertainty as to who I am. No, this is who I fucking am. I'm the guy that everyone loves right now. So I think part of my checking the score is a little bit of that, you know, that delusion of a self that I'm chasing, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're probably familiar with Alan Watts. He's got a gazillion great quotes. One of my favorites is around the ego, which if I remember this correctly, it's something like the ego, which he believes himself to be, is nothing but a pattern of habits. And so we can think about the ego being reinforced in the very same way as any other habit. And so we can, an ego can be a fraught term. So think of it as anything that we're identified with can be a nugget of ego. So for example, somebody sees themselves as a chocolate connoisseur, you know, and they, you know, they're like, I have I like this type of chocolate. Somebody says, well, that type of chocolate sucks. Well, they've just threatened that person's ego.
Right. You know?
Because they're identified with that type of chocolate. So in that sense, any of these nuggets can be reinforced in the same way as any other habit.
Right. And I guess in that identification is also a feeling of security. Mm-hmm. Of course, we're so vulnerable because we're actually not secure. Someone's going to come along who knows more about chocolate, or one day I'm going to post something that isn't as popular, or there's a million people out there posting stuff. It's all very self-referential the way I engage in these ways. And then you combine that with, and this is something you touched upon in your book, just how maybe sinister these algorithms are on the part of Instagram, for example. You, not only are you getting hits of your ideal self, but they're manipulating the system so that you get as addicted as possible as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, they're leveraging every single piece of basically, you know, dopamine driving technology that has been discovered. So, you know, it's intermittent reinforcement, meaning you don't know when you're going to get, you know, a reward, for example. It's the surprise element. It's movement. You know, it's all of these things. And so you can see that a lot of these things are even designed like slot machines, because there's a lot known and a lot's been studied around slot machines to get people addicted. That's why the scroll feels like a slot machine, because it's designed based on that. On top of that, you know, we might ask, well, what is it about this, you know, this stable sense of self that our minds crave? If we look at that, that really goes back to survival as well. So if you think about it, if our ancient ancestors out on the savannah, they've got to be on the alert, because if they're going to a new place of the savannah that they haven't mapped out, they don't know if the lions or the saber-toothed tigers or the bears or whatever, you know, or whatever are out there. So they have to be on alert. So that uncertainty drives our survival brain to be on alert, to look for, you know, danger and run away if necessary. Once we've mapped that out, we start to get a sense of certainty. We're like, okay, this is safe. And so that's a survival piece. So here you can think of it as our brains really don't like uncertainty. And the more we, in our modern day, we can create this feeling of certainty where we say, oh, you know, you can create your little cocoon, your safe space where you don't have to be threatened by anything, because you can just ignore the stuff that you don't like. And you can just focus on the stuff you like. And if you're on social media, you can mute all the people that might disagree with you or tell you that you're being racist or whatever. Right. And you're like, oh, I like being racist. I'm just going to mute that person. And, you know, I'm not saying that I do. I'm saying people can do that. Mm. And so here we can create these cocoons of safety where it's basically just familiarity. And we can just get rid of all the stuff that's not familiar. And so more and more, it's harder to actually tolerate distress, which is actually a necessary piece of life, because life is always changing.
Right. It's that component of being with some, I guess it's because, I mean, I'll just talk about my own experience. I equate uncertainty with something that's a threat. This is threatening and dangerous, and therefore I need to avoid it. I need to just stay in my YouTube hole and watch the same things that I have continued to watch. For me, it's like old tennis matches from the 90s, and then the algorithm spits them back at me.
Right.
And then I have even more to watch, and I can kind of, it becomes very conditioned, and these are very like deeply set grooves that my brain goes in to feel good and safe. And this is the only, you know, I don't have to consume any other reality than the one that I'm already comfortable consuming.
Right, right. And the algorithms are set up to make it more and more and more comfortable, because, you know, they're agnostic. They're just trying to get us to pay attention so they can throw ads at us. So the more they can get us to pay attention, the more they can make revenue, because, you know, these are revenue generating machines. But the way to do that is to help us get more and more in a groove so that we're going to stay in that groove.
Yeah. And so I guess the third habit loop, and this one's a little bit, at least to me, a little bit more complex, is, you know, the behavior of, I have a ton of anxious planning thoughts. I will plan the shit out of even just which coffee. I live in I live in Park Slope, Brooklyn. I'm not yet famous enough where that's a problem that I announced that. Maybe by the time this episode comes out. But anyway, I love coffee. There are a ton of amazing coffee shops around me. Sometimes I go back and forth. My girlfriend calls it waffling. I'm coffle waffling is the term I've come up with in terms of which place am I going to go to this morning? Mm-hmm. And then I'll like schedule the week. And then I'm like, shit, I should have went to the other place. And I really just get caught up in these loops is the best way to put it, because it just goes, I just chew on it over and over again. I play out the day if I were to go to this place or that place. And there are times when it gets, when I'm aware that these are very silly stakes, and sometimes this habit loop will play out with, you know, different kinds of plans in terms of maybe a trip or something else. And I just keep churning, I crunching numbers on which is the better option. And the result is that I'm just exhausted from anxiety. And at first glance, it's like, well, how can that be a loop if it doesn't serve me any type of reward, right?
Yeah. So unpacking that, we can look at this as, you know, another part of our survival brain, which is set up to help us plan for the future. So planning for the future helps us survive. You know, if we've got to catch a plane, it's helpful to plan how long you need to get to the airport and all the things that you need to do. But when we make the plan, we check it maybe once or twice to make sure we haven't missed anything. And then our brain starts spinning out in the, well, what if, you know, Uber goes on strike? You know, what if the, you know, what if? All those what ifs start spinning us out into these worst case scenarios. We start to get anxious. And then that's literally just spinning our wheels. It doesn't help us survive. And so we can see how even our brain gets co-opted with all this choice. You know, it's like, oh, which coffee should I get? Because our brain is always trying to optimize outcomes. You know, it's like, well, maybe this coffee will be better on this guy. Maybe the barista on Tuesdays, it's this barista. On Thursdays, it's a barista somewhere else. And, you know, they make the best coffee. And what we've got to realize that spinning out is actually making us suffer. It's not actually helping with anything.
Yeah. And yet, it's funny because I am a trained mindfulness teacher. I've put out hours of podcasts at this point about anxiety. And I've certainly talked about the tools that have helped me. I've gotten a ton of feedback from listeners who say that the things that we've discussed have helped them. Yet 3 days ago, I was in my room going, okay, should I take the train to Central Park and should I walk around there? Or maybe I'll just do Prospect Park, but even though that's familiar, and I'm just getting caught up, and this will last like 40 minutes to an hour. And it's so sticky. And to your point, it's like I can be aware that this is silly, yet I'll just be like, okay, no, let's just do it for 5 more minutes and then I'll put it down, because we should be putting it down, because I'm a good meditator and I know that the wisdom is to just be in the body. I'll drop into the body in exactly 5 minutes, but for now I'm going to figure this out. It's so sticky.
Yeah. So this is where I think some more neuroscience can be helpful. And this was something that I found really helpful. So, and this actually brings together some of the really core Buddhist concepts and modern neuroscience. So here, the word on the street was, you know, thus it was said that the Buddha was contemplating dependent origination on the night of his enlightenment. And I actually published a paper in a scientific journal almost 10 years ago now, I worked together with a Pali scholar, Jake Davis, showing that basically dependent origination was the first version of reinforcement learning. You know, it was discovered back before paper was even invented. And so I think here, you know, the parallels between dependent origination and operant conditioning or reinforcement learning, you know, they're uncanny. I think it's really the same thing. And that's what we argued in this paper. So here, looking back at that, you know, and if you look at some of the suttas, the Buddha talks about exploring gratification to its end, you know, basically summarizing it. He says it wasn't until I explored gratification to its end that knowledge and vision arose. And that, if I could only take one sentence of the entire Pali Canon with me, that would be the sentence or the distillation. Wow. I would take. And the reason I would do that, not only was he like, this is why I got enlightened, so pay attention. But there's a reason for that. And it is, if we are not seeing we have to see really, really clearly exactly what the results are of our behavior, or we're never going to change them. So fast forward to modern day, there's actually a mathematical formula for this. It was two researchers in the 70s, Rescorla and Wagner, wrote out this formula that said, you know, a habit's going to get set up, and the only way to change that habit is through updating the reward value. And the only way to update the reward value is not through shoulds, but through awareness. So I'm glad you brought up, you know, oh, I should stop doing this, but I'm gonna do it for 5 more minutes. It's about really paying attention and asking, what am I getting from this right now? That's what the Buddha, I would interpret as saying, exploring gratification to its end. So just to give you a concrete example, my lab just published study using this for Skorla-Wagner modeling, where in our Eat Right Now app, we embedded a mindfulness exercise where we had people, as they were craving a substance to either overeat it or eat junk food, had them pay attention as they ate it, and then report back on how rewarding it actually was through a contentment score. Right. Ready for this? It only took them 10 to 15 times of paying attention for that reward value to drop below zero. And when it dropped below zero, they shifted their behavior. Not through willpower, not through force, not through shooting, like I shouldn't eat this or I shouldn't overeat, but through simply seeing how unrewarding it was. They explored gratification to its end.
Right, but and how long, that's incredible too. And how long are we tracking these people, and are there any slippages?
It's a good question. So the main focus of that study was to look at change in reward value. So certainly it doesn't mean that, you know, nobody will, you know, it's not like they all never overate ever again, because we didn't track them that long, but we would track them over a course of a couple of months. The thing about that is when we can bring awareness in each time, it's kind of like you can't unsee something that you saw. You know, for example, my patients with cigarettes, when I have them pay attention as they smoke, they can't untaste how crappy a cigarette tastes, right? And they and so it changes that thing forever. You know, they're like, oh, this is how it is. I've had people come in and jokingly say to me, you know, oh, you ruined this junk food for me. Because yeah, they're like, they can't go back and enjoy it anymore because it just doesn't taste very good when they pay attention.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed mindful eating, and it is true. Like I traditionally would think of a piece of raw broccoli as not as appealing as a potato chip, but you pay attention and the broccoli is very satisfying. Yeah. It tastes good. There's a rich texture to it. It feels good to be eating a plant. And you contrast that with a potato chip, or I think I've heard you speak to the example of a gummy worm or something you were talking about where it is just, you pay attention to it and it just registers as something fake and processed and unpleasant, and why would I put my body through this? I also think that when you're mindful, there's less getting in the way of the sensory experience. It's almost when I am caught up in layer upon layer of thought and rumination, I almost need a bacon cheeseburger to cut through that and to get me to feel something.
Yes.
A collard green isn't going to cut through that noise.
Yes. It's kind of like if somebody's yelling in the room, you've got to yell louder.
Right,
and with the rumination, the bacon cheeseburger yells pretty loudly.
It yells pretty loudly if it's from TGI Fridays. And even then you pay attention and you're like, well, this is crap. However, what if I'm eating a $35 bacon cheeseburger from one of these fancy Brooklyn restaurants. Everything is artisanal. It's grass-fed, pasture-raised, you know, heirloom bacon. And so if I'm mindful then, I can at least acknowledge that this is quality and well-made. It's not quite as easy as discarding gummy worms. So what to do in that case?
Well, one, I don't know about you, but my experience has often been I go and I buy something, you know, that's supposed to be, you know, all this fancy stuff and it's really expensive. And I notice, I'm like, you know, it actually doesn't taste that different than, you know, the thing that was 1/10 of the cost. And so I get disenchanted because my wallet feels the burn.
Right.
And it's like, oh, it's, you know, it's great to save the planet, but, you know, and you know, if we look at this, is this the best way to save the planet by, you know, overspending on something that sounds fancy but actually doesn't taste that great? You can't dress up something that is crap in the sense that you just can't make gummy worms, for example, taste better, even if they are grass-fed gummy worms, so to speak.
Okay, yeah, I like that. I also... Yeah, even just realizing, okay, these are animals that were murdered, and what about all of the cost that went into that? And I am the end customer to that process. Maybe that doesn't feel so good. But also, what about just zooming out? Like, okay, maybe that evening, let's say it was delicious and I just was enthralled by this pleasant experience, but then maybe the next morning I don't feel as good as if I had had a salad. And that's, you know, we're not just paying attention for during the experience, but then during after the experience, right?
Yes, absolutely. And you're highlighting the critical aspect of how reward changes. So this also goes back to Buddhism. The Buddha talked about cause and effect. And in modern day neuroscience, we talk about that in terms of reward value. What's the behavior and how rewarding is the behavior? And it's not just in the moment, because often, you know, these, it's like bright, shiny objects. They capture our attention and we're all excited. And then we realize, oh, you know, we have a hangover, or we feel crappy in the morning, or we're sluggish, or for me, I get a sugar rush and crash from gummy worms. And so it's looking at all of the results. And as far out as we can map the results, the more that's going to help us get a very, very clear picture of how rewarding or unrewarding the behavior is.
Thank you for laying that out. I do want to ask, okay, so we're saying shoulds and willpower don't really work, but is there room to use them occasionally, like especially after we've already understood it experientially, as you're recommending? Okay, so for example, let's say I've paid attention and have now become disenchanted to gummy worms. And I'm like, oh, this is actually plastic garbage. What am I eating? And then I naturally, as I'm more in tune to my body, I'm naturally craving healthier food, salads, and I'm in tune to how nourishing they are, and I'm following my intuition, and my intuition is now being updated by this process. But let's say after a while, I end up on a bad patch of like a couple shitty days, bad sleep, emotional turbulence, whatever. And now my system is compromised. And now I want the crack. Now I want the gummy worms. Like in this case, is a should okay? Maybe just to like white knuckle myself through the craving, especially because I've already mapped it out organically. And now I'm just trying to get back to my map. Does that make sense?
So I would say it depends. Mm. So sometimes it can be helpful to kind of white knuckle our way away from it so we can get enough distance so we can see what's happening. And sometimes it, you know, it's actually helpful just to let the body indulge, obviously, if it's not something that's going to kill us or kill somebody else.
Right.
And so, you know, every time we indulge, we can actually be gathering information and be like, okay, I'm going to go for it, but let me see if I can pay attention or even reflect back on the experience afterwards. So I can get a really clear sense of what I got from it. I can kind of go in with my eyes a little more wide open, because that in itself can be really good information, can be good data.
Totally. Yeah, I asked that question because for me, I think something that's helped, but it's taken a little bit of discernment and maybe skill to maybe know when to apply it, is to just be like, you know, you've had an experience. Right now you're craving the unhealthy thing more than the healthy thing. But you can trust that the healthy thing is better based on actual embodied experience, not just shoulds. But right now it needs to be a should just to kind of kickstart me back to that momentum of good habit, right?
Yes.
And it's worked sometimes. And you're right. Sometimes it's maybe getting me a little bit more bogged down in shame and, you know, don't do this, don't do that, which might notch up the anxiety anyway. So it's complex.
It is. And I think this also brings us back to the term sati, which can, I'm not a Pali scholar, but I will play one on a podcast. you know, that can be, I've heard it translated as to remember or remembering. And one way that we can do that, we can look at that is, you know, we can should our way out of something. Oh, I should stop. I should not be eating this. But we can also just take a moment to reflect back, you know, recall, well, what was it like the last time I ate the crap versus what was it like the last time I didn't eat the crap? And that recollection can actually be a lot more powerful than the shoulds, because it draws up that disenchantment. And we're like, why would I want to do that when we're seeing clearly? And that recollection is about recalling what happened, you know, what the cause and effect was clearly. So that's something that we can even throw in there and experiment with. You know, it's like, okay, I'm stuck in this rut. Well, what's it like to recall the last time I did it versus trying to should my way out of this?
Okay, yeah, that's good. And so, yeah, we've kind of merged seamlessly into what you've referred to as second gear, which is just this act of paying attention. Do the things that we crave, like, do they nourish us the way that we expect them to? And a lot of times what happens is when we're not paying attention, we just assume that they did nourish us, and then we just keep craving that thing.
Yes, yes.
Thus, the pattern.
Our brains are great at tricking us and saying, oh, that was good. No, forget about the bad stuff. It was good. Do it again.
Yeah. And I think, so I was reading about dukkha. I mean, that's one of the foundational components of Buddhism, which is this, I understand it as, I mean, it's pretty much all suffering. It doesn't mean that life is always going to be suffering, but I think the particular type of suffering that Buddhism tends to speak to is the type of suffering that ensues when we are craving for something that's going to be lasting or something that's going to fill us up in some comprehensive way. And it turns out that all experience is empty of any type of essence that could land us in anything permanent, whether it's a permanent situation or feeling of goodness, or maybe it's or any type of a permanent self. And when I pay attention to, let's say I'm craving something unhealthy and I'm maybe mindlessly devouring it. And sometimes when I do that, I come online for a second and I could kind of catch myself, like there's some feeling as though if I'm just kind of, I'm eating so fast and it feels as though I'm racing towards an orgasm that never quite comes.
Yeah.
And it's only when I pay attention that I realize this. I'm like, wait, I'm expecting the pleasure to just notch up into just setting me free forever. Yet the next bite is only going to be as good as this bite.
Right.
And it's all just this temporary experience.
Yeah.
And that's been powerful for me. I think that's kind of what you're getting at.
Absolutely. I'm curious if you've noticed this yourself. Often we're not paying attention to the bite that's in our mouth because we're anticipating the next one.
Yeah.
So absolutely. The irony is like, oh, this is really tasty food, but I'm not actually paying attention to how it tastes because I'm looking forward to the next fry or the next lick of the ice cream cone. I'm not actually paying attention to the ice cream that's actually in my mouth right now. It's crazy.
Yeah, that speaks to so many different experiences. I was just in the park this past Saturday. It was a beautiful night. And as soon as I kind of found some ground and looked out at the trees, and it was around sunset, so the light was amazing. And I just immediately started planning, oh, when can I do this again with my friends? And then I started feeling a scarcity.
Yeah.
I was like, the amazingness of that evening existed only to torture me about what it could be if other people were here with me and I need to plan that.
Yes, yes. What was there's a great quote from John Lennon, I think. He says, you know, life is what happens. Life passes us by as we're planning.
When you're making other plans.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And then, yeah, you finish the meal and, yeah, unless you're paying attention, you might walk away from that experience thinking that it was that you need to keep having that experience. And that's what life is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I guess I eventually want to get to this third gear, which is curiosity. I mean, we're kind of bringing in all the wisdom into each module. I kind of had a formal outline, which as outlines, to your point about, or John Lennon's point about plans. Life is, podcasts are what happens when you're trying to stick to your outline.
Yeah. Well, I'll add here, you know, if we think about, you know, first gear is about mapping out these habit loops, right? If we can't map them out, we can't work with them. Mm-hmm. Then we can shift into second gear where we're kind of building momentum and we can start to look at that cause and effect relationship and ask ourselves,
right,
you know, what am I getting from this? And what that does is build momentum for our brains, because our brains are always looking for something better, right? You know, it's like, what's the best coffee? We're trying to optimize outcomes. So
yeah,
here we can tap into that and give, you know, help our brains find the bigger, better offer. So I think of third gear as the BBO, the bigger, better offer. And here it's not just about finding the better coffee or the better ice cream, because we're just going to be stuck in that endless loop of always searching for more. You know, this could be a romantic partner, you know, job, car, clothes, you know, it's everything. So there, this is about finding something that is internally rewarding, because we don't become habituated, tend to not to become habituated to things that are internal, like internal rewards. And then also importantly, finding a reward that doesn't feel the same and ideally is more rewarding. That's why it's a bigger, better offer than these other ones. So as, for example, when we crave something, it tends to feel kind of closed down, contractive. It's driving. It says, go get that food, right? So when excitement, for example, tends to be more contracted as compared to opened up and expanded, because it's driving us to go do something. We're anticipating, you know, whatever it is, the first kiss or the eating the burger or the ice cream or the drinking the coffee. So here, what is more rewarding? Well, my lab has done studies showing that the feeling of expansion feels better than the feeling of contraction. So take obvious examples. Anxiety feels contracting. Feeling frustrated feels contracting. Anger, contracted. Those all drive us to do things. In contrast to this, curiosity, kindness, connection feel more open. And what we found is that it feels better to feel open, these open states, as compared to these closed states. So there's a natural reward hierarchy that our brain has set up for these open states. And so I think of third gear as being, you know, generally speaking, something that opens us up. And two of the main flavors, if you want to think of, you know, the multiple flavors of experience, two of the main buckets there are curiosity and kindness. Both of them feel open, and both of them are more rewarding than, say, anxiety or, you know, divisiveness or, you know, disconnection.
Yeah, and correct me if I'm wrong, I also see it as kindness helps you find more and more things to be curious about, because you're creating this aura of self-acceptance, which enables you to maybe look at stuff without maybe being afraid of it a little bit more. And then you can absolutely keep maybe staying in that curious space.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can think of this. I like the work of Carol Dweck, who's a Stanford professor who looked at, in the educational space, fixed versus growth mindset. Basically, you can think of fixed mindset as, you know, this is the way things are. They're never going to change. That tends to be closed. We're not in a space where we can actually learn. Growth mindset is more open, where we can lean into our experience, and instead of saying, oh no, this is, you know, this is the way it is, we can go, oh, well, here's, you know, what can I learn from this? And so kindness opens us up so we can be more in a growth mindset. Curiosity opens us up so we can be more in a growth mindset. Both of them can feed off of each other. I think if I'm understanding what you're saying, yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah. And is being curious also another way to say that we're being present to the truth, whereas when we're anxious, we're maybe running away from the truth, which might be something unpleasant or some emotional thing that we're trying to stamp out?
Yes, absolutely. So with anxiety, because it's unpleasant, we tend to turn away from our experience. With curiosity, almost by definition, we're turning toward our experience. When we go, oh, what is this? We have to look at it. And so it helps us actually turn toward our experience.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about this through the lens of another habit loop that I mapped out that I haven't yet shared, which is that I love having imaginary conversations with people. A lot of times there are arguments that I'm winning because they're happening in my head. I call that home field advantage. Yes. And so I'll have a, you know, something will come up. Maybe it's something that, something rude someone said to me. You know, I'm embarrassed to say that I'll still have stuff flare up that someone said to me in like high school or something. Or more recently, maybe it's somebody in my life who's maybe a little bit toxic. And then so I start to argue with them in my head, and I'll win the argument, say the thing that will kind of put them in their place, and then I'll feel better. Mm-hmm. And so that's a habit loop. And then I'm kind of, when I become more curious about it before I engage in this mental dialogue, I could be like, wait a minute, is the fact that this person, you know, is the fact that they're saying this to me in my head actually a threat that I need to bother defending against at all? Like, is it even the case that I need to argue against it in order to feel safe?
Right.
And so you become more and more conscious to these anxious thoughts being maybe a little bit more dreamlike. You know, I mean, it's not just that we can look back and say, oh, this didn't serve me, or this just dug me further into a hole of anxiety. And that's obviously very useful, but also to just experience it in real time as something that's a complete mental construction.
Absolutely. A complete mental construction that serves one purpose, which is to reify the self.
Right, right.
So home field advantage is all about me, you know, and every time we spin that wheel, we're reifying some type of self-concept. And that in itself is generally not healthy.
So is there a belief in there that, like, I am, you know, my adequacy as a person is something that continually needs to be shorn up? Or maybe it's true that that's maybe something that I can just give myself a blanket acceptance, you know, a blanket sense of loving kindness that, no, I am a worthy person because I'm alive. I'm a part of humanity. My flaws are there for whatever reasons. I can't completely think of them as my fault. I am, you know, causes and conditions happened, and I am a being just like any other being. And so it doesn't matter that this person has this opinion of me. Even if this person had one of me in real life, it wouldn't matter, let alone my version of them in my head.
Right, right. So that not only helps us let go of our own concepts about, you know, how we're spinning our wheels, but it can also help us start to develop compassion by, you know, standing next to the other and reminding ourselves, oh yeah, their experience, their behaviors are also a result of causes and conditions. Is it their fault? You know?
Oh. Yeah.
And when we see that, you know, they're no different than we are, we start to empathize with them a little bit more. It's harder to blame them for their conditioning, just like it's harder to blame ourselves for our own conditioning.
Mm.
So the more we can see that in our own experience, the more we can actually see that in other people's experience. And that helps us start to develop compassion because,
right,
you know, how can we blame somebody for something that's not their fault?
Mm. Yeah, well said. Yeah, and I also want to go back to maybe this idea of anxiety being a habit loop, even in the absence of any palpable reward. You know, just because that feels as though when I'm not aware that I'm in this dream, that feels as though, even though it feels awful, even when I'm in it, mm-hmm. the fact that it feels awful isn't a reason to get out of it. It's more that it feels real.
Yes.
You know?
Real, and I would add a phrase or a word, comfortable, right? So
yeah,
one thing our brains don't like is they don't like uncertainty and they don't like change. And so if we've set up our fortress around, you know, the identification with being an anxious person, and then we start to step out of it, that can be very scary. For example, I even wrote about one of my clinic patients in my book. I call him Dave. And he'd been anxious by the time he came to see me, he was about 40 years of age. He'd been anxious for about 30 years, so 3/4 of his life. And as he started to work out of those anxiety habit loops, I remember him coming into my office one day and saying, man, I'm getting anxious that I'm not anxious, because he was so identified with his anxiety. And that was just about change. So we worked on helping him see that it was okay not to be anxious. This was just a different him. And it was so unfamiliar to him that it was making him uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's unfamiliar is definitely resonates. It feels, how it feels to me when I put down anxiety is it feels irresponsible to let go of anxious thoughts because that's where I've assumed the control of life is.
Yes, that's quite an assumption.
Yeah, and now, although it's shitty, it's like, no, this is what needs to happen so that I become safe. And again, when I'm unconscious of that, I'm not paying attention to, like, when I'm actually at the trip that I overanalyzed, that I went to this trip instead of that trip. When I'm actually there, it's not as though all of that analysis really helped or all of my kind of visualizing of what it would be like was actually correspondent to the experience. It's not like I'm aware of any of that. I'm just so in this habit loop of thinking that the reality in front of me isn't reality. The reality is up in my mind and all of the, you know, terrain that I've constructed, just my reliance on that. And the more I do that, the more it self-reinforces.
Absolutely. Yep. And this is where that reinforcement, our brains love to make they take correlations and they attribute causality to these correlations. So for example, you know, oh, I need to be anxious to get work done, for example, right? This anxiety is what helped me have control of life. Well, correlation does not equal causation. Just because somebody was anxious and something happened doesn't mean that the anxiety caused it to happen. But when we don't check those assumptions, our brains will just just assume that that's true. Oh, because I was anxious, this got done. And what that does is it reinforces that concept. I am an anxious person. This is the only way I can go through life, as an example.
Yeah. Tell me what you think of this. This is my own, you know, maybe armchair PhD theory about why I do this, which is that, you know, I obsessively play out option A versus option B. And if I can replay the tape often enough, then I'll see that one answer is clearly right and will clearly grant me safety, or that one option is clearly wrong and will lead to suffering. So in a way, it's a way to kind of think my way into security.
Yes. So this, you know, this goes back to our survival brains trying to predict the future. And so if we can predict the future, then we can, you know, say, okay, high probability that this is going to happen, I'm going to do this because that's the best outcome. But we can't think our way into things being certain. But that's what our brains think. Oh, the more I think about this, the more likely it is to be certain. That's not true. It just, the more likely it is to make us anxious. That is true.
Right, right. And then, so the question that often comes up, usually on my part when I'm listening to a conversation like this, is, well, I need to plan my life. I can't just stop planning. Mm-hmm. And I guess we have to make a distinction between obsessive planning and functional planning, right?
Right. So here, if we can bring awareness to the situations, we can start to get a sense for how complex is the task. So how much do I need to plan? How many times do I need to double check my plan? And where does that flip from being helpful? You know, I missed something. Okay, that was helpful to check it twice. Versus, you know, when we're on the 17th round of planning and we're just making ourselves more anxious or getting lost in that planning, we can start to see how unhelpful that is. So here we can look at the cause and effect relationship again and ask, where's that flip from helpful planning to unhelpful over planning?
Yeah. And so, right. So helpful planning to me maybe is not that this is my habit, but it would look like having a plan with the understanding that this plan isn't going to guarantee the best outcome. Having a plan with the understanding that the way I'm visualizing things isn't necessarily how they're going to unfold. I shouldn't just get attached to my thoughts in that way or mistake the thoughts for reality. And maybe a signal for when it's sliding into unhealthy planning is when I'm kind of, there's this obsessive kind of, I keep playing out scenarios, chewing on them, seeing if I could think my way into clarity. That to me is a signal that it's gone off the rails.
Yes, absolutely. And so this can go back to this, you know, we can drop into our direct experience and check to see, am I all wound up? Am I all contracted? That might be a sign that we're in the unhealthy territory versus, oh, here's a plan. It makes sense. And as part of that, we're building in, you know, X percentage for things to change, right? So that's also part of the healthy planning. It's like, I'm not trying to force the future. I'm simply planning the best I can. And as part of that, knowing that plans change.
Right. And is there any type of bodily awareness that might help us make that distinction?
I think here, you're looking at, you know, just the feeling of contraction versus expansion is probably the simplest way to do it. You know, I found that that's so helpful in so many aspects of life. You know, am I judging somebody versus truly discerning behavior? Well, contraction tends to indicate judging, you know, discerning behavior. It tends to be more open and accepting. So I think it can be helpful in many areas of life.
Awesome. So I have a couple more questions and then I know you got to go. This is a fairly, well, to me, it's a big question. And I'm just going to maybe tell you where I've landed with this and see what you think. So what I found really mind-blowing isn't just maybe examining the rewards associated with various desires. What mindfulness to me has also uncovered is that the desires themselves aren't even what my mind is presenting them to be. And just as an example, I will start to have a craving of, oh, I need to hang out with this person, or I need this person's approval, or maybe I need this job, anything really. And then when you pay more attention to it, maybe it's true that I'm just on a deeper vibrational level, more just looking for connection. Mm-hmm. And I think the mistake my mind makes is, once again, it's like, oh, I'm craving, you know, back when I was single, this person's affection. And then therefore I go on thinking, well, this person is the one source of that thing. When in reality, what the desire is something a little bit more formless, which means, the good news is, it means that we can meet that desire in many more ways than we think we can, right?
Yes, yes. And I think one way that I like to explore that is, you know, if there's a desire, if there's a want there, I can ask myself, what do I actually need? And there's often a difference, you know, that wanting is the superficial manifestation, this phenotype of something that's deeper that has a need. And if we can actually pinpoint what that need is, we can actually meet that need. And often it's not in the same way that the desire thought that it could, but it really gets, you know, it scratches that itch as compared to scratching all over our body trying to find the itch.
Yeah. And sometimes I have to be careful not to let that become its own anxious figuring out process of like, oh, what's actually the desire? Tell me if you think this is cool. If sometimes when I can't exactly define the desire or get to the bottom of it, let's just go out and see. Let's just, if I think this is what I'm craving, let's just do it. Let's activate and then maybe, yeah, observe.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to do it. You know, let's do the experiment. Okay, let's see if this actually scratches the itch, or does it just make me itch more?
Cool. So I have one more question. Just on a personal level, how has your own anxiety changed since you began all of this research and writing?
Well, I would have to say, personally, it's been transformational. I can't imagine how I could get through life without these tools. You know, for example, I started getting panic attacks back in residency training. And fortunately, I'd been meditating about 8 or 9 years at that point. I started meditating at the beginning of medical school. And I found that I was doing noting practice hardcore at that time. And I found that noting practice was just absolutely life-saving in terms of helping me be able to see the thoughts, see the emotions, see the physical sensations for what they were and not get caught up in them. So I could literally just note my way through a panic attack, note that I had a panic attack. I could go through the diagnostic checklist because I was in residency at the time, like check, 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 check. Oh, I just had a panic attack. And then they would wake me up from sleep. And then I'd just go back to sleep, not worrying that there was something wrong with me. It's like, oh, panic attack, now it's time to sleep. So for me, it's been transformational. And I'd have to say, you know, personally, it's been helpful, but it's been so helpful in terms of me being able to help my patients. You know, I can't think of anything that's more gratifying. This might sound really cheesy, right? So sorry about that, but honestly, it feels pretty good to help people, you know, to be of service in this world as compared to just being a consumer. And so not only has it helped me personally, but I can bring in my personal experience and you know, my patients will believe me when I'm like, hey, look, this worked for me, you know, and so that there's some face validity there. But also, it's really gratifying to see my patients do really well, you know, whether it's in our clinical studies or in my clinic itself.
Wow, that is great to hear. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Judd. It's been a pleasure.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, that was my conversation with Dr. Judd Brewer. Once again, his book is Unwinding Anxiety. It's available everywhere. His social media handles and website information is in the episode description. You can contact me at theanxietylab@gmail.com. I always love hearing from people. So far, I haven't gotten any hate, but who the hell knows? Maybe you could be you could be the first. If it's something you're really feeling in your heart, and if you're gonna criticize me, just remember, do it from a place of remember that we're all on this rock hurtling through space together. Just keep that in mind as you pick me apart in totality, perhaps. Throw me a rating, throw me a review if you can. It doesn't take long. And that's all I got. Hope you can be kind to yourself. And once again, we're doing this every 2 weeks, and I can't wait for the next one. Well, I can. I guess I decided I should be waiting, or that we all should be waiting longer. But I am excited. I got a great episode as well for number 3. Take care. Bye.